Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based wrestling program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guests. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. Welcome to a special edition with our guest, Rick Knox.
Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys Podcasting. I'm your host, DJ Impact, and I have a couple of the bad boys here with me, like King Lucky.
Hey, what's going on? How's it going?
Good, good, man. Living it up. Matt Michaels.
I'm feeling pretty elite right now.
Elite?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you got rich or something over the weekend?
It's about to get dangerous.
Oh, no, no, no. Didn't get rich, but we definitely have a Rick who knows about being elite.
Ah, oh, okay. I like how you went there. Awesome. Well, there we go. We have a guy on the phone that you've probably seen him referee one of your favorite matches. Now, he was a PWG original, worked for PCW Ultra, AWS, Ground Zero, El Rey Networks, Lucha Underground, last year's All In, this year's Double or Nothing. Look, he is officially the referee for AEW. Vegas Bad Boys, welcome Rick Knox. Hey, Rick.
Thank you.
No doubt. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
No doubt.
So we're going to swing into the important questions first. And that is, did you get to see Godzilla, and what did you think?
Yeah, finally. I mean, it was a long time coming. I literally just got to see it last night. I went to, like, the late night showing, and it was cool. I dug it. It was a little long. Plot got a little convoluted at some points, and some of the banter and dialogue was pretty bad. But overall, I mean, it was cool. The monsters were good. I liked the backstory. There were a few cool nods and homages to the old Japanese original Toho stuff. So I dug it. It was pretty cool.
Do you think it's a good setup for the King Kong Godzilla movie?
Ooh. Yeah, I did. I think they did a really good job of establishing the monster universe and all that. I never watched, never saw Skull Island, the Kong movie.
Oh, wow.
I never saw that. So kind of seeing this movie, I thought they really did a good job of, like, kind of just planting that seed of the whole monster universe. I mean, in that one movie, I thought they did a good job of establishing something that can really produce a good run of films for the next several years, I think.
Well, I'll tell you, you definitely got to set aside some time. Not that you're going to have any extra time coming up soon, but set aside some time to really watch that movie because it was so well done. I thought the production was great. The actors that were part of it were awesome, and I was a huge fan of that movie. So I'm a little bit miffed that I haven't got out to see Godzilla yet.
Then you'll dig Godzilla. You'll dig Godzilla. I actually have the Skull Island on DVD or a Blu-ray, just haven't busted the time to watch it yet.
Well, on one of the trips now, you'll be able to slip that in. And
Absolutely.
Exactly. So speaking of, you know, career, good things are happening. But let's go back a little bit early on because of the fact that you trained to be a wrestler at the School of Hard Knocks for EWF, right?
Well, not really. I mean, I went there kind of to check it out. I mean, I didn't really think that I was going to... I was honest with myself. I didn't think I was going to have what it took. So I wanted to see for myself up close. So when I did get a first-hand view of the bumps that these guys were taking and what they really go through, I pretty much realized that, yeah, I don't think I'm cut out to do this on a normal basis. So that's kind of, you know, and I thought, okay, so I got a couple options here. I can maybe shoot to be like a manager or something, but I always felt that manager had kind of a short shelf life, and I don't know, referee just seemed like the way to go because you were kind of involved in the entire show, somewhat still physical. You maybe took a bump here or there, and, you know, it wasn't... It, it wasn't as taxing as being a wrestler, but you were still involved for the entire show for the most part. So that's kind of, I kind of went in to be a referee, actually, once I really got going. I had no illusions. I knew I wasn't going to be a wrestler.
So just out of curiosity then, I know I trained UPW early 2000s, and I know what the wrestling training is like. What kind of things do you do in terms of being a referee that you're taught, and who was the mentor that you had?
Basically, as far as like a training regimen or anything, there really was nothing. It was all just practice. It was basically apprenticeship, for lack of a better word. It was get in the ring and do it. I used to literally go to the school on Tuesdays and Thursdays and basically sit there and watch the guys train. And when they were done with their class at about 10 o'clock at night, the guys who still stuck around would have practice matches, and that would be my chance to get in the ring. And that's basically how I learned. I probably did that for 6 months before I actually did a real show in front of an audience, maybe even longer than that. And it was finally just at the insistence of some of the wrestlers being like, hey, you know, you guys need to book this guy. He's pretty good. You should use him on the shows. And but as far as like who was kind of directing me and giving me direction, any direction that I got back then pretty much came from Jesse Hernandez. It really did. And but you know, it wasn't like he really had a specific regimen for me or anything like that. It's just, like I said, we just got in there and did it. And you know, if he saw something that looked kind of goofy, he'd tell me. Or if he saw something that looked good, he would tell me. And just kind of went from there, basically.
And during that time period, too, did you, like, who were some of the guys that you first saw? Like, do you remember, was there, like, a Christopher Daniels or, you know, mm-hmm. someone that listeners might know who
When I first started showing up at the EWF and School of Hard Knocks, Chris Daniels was there, and he was probably one of the first guys that really blew me away. I saw him, was like, this guy's a pro. He's obviously he's on a higher level than a lot of these other guys at the school here. So whenever he was around, I always made sure to show up and kind of soak up whatever I could from him. Bobby Bradley was another guy. Yeah. Louis Spicoli was another guy. Who was there in the early days of when I first showed up, and another guy who was just starting out his career was Rico Costantino.
Yeah.
And these are all guys who, you know, went on to do really good things, and were already starting to do some pretty good things. And my very first I think show I did was maybe the first match Frankie Kazarian actually worked out in California.
Wow.
Too. But, yeah.
So, you know, when you go through this whole process of first, you know, seeing how it was, how the guys were taking bumps and training and things like that, did you at one point ever get discouraged from ever doing anything? I mean, I know you've been around the business, you love the business, but did you ever get discouraged about pursuing this and keep going with it?
That's a good question. I don't think I ever got discouraged until the injuries started happening. Early on, when it was just kind of like, well, this isn't, you know, I'm just stuck doing indies. I'm never going to go to WWF or anything like that. I never really had that set in my head that that's what I wanted to do. I was kind of just enjoying the ride. I mean, you know, I've been doing this over 20 years now, but when I really think back, those first couple years are some of the funnest years that I can remember. You know, those memories of those first couple years are just amazing. I'll never forget that time. And it's a little bit of a different scenario as far as when you get hurt and then you start getting discouraged. I mean, when I broke my collarbone last year, I mean, I was pretty much prepared to be done. I said, this is it. I can't do this again. I can't take another bump like this. It was devastating. It crushed me. I mean, That one one of my hand injuries when I shattered my pinky finger and I basically couldn't draw and write again and had to learn that all over. I cried. I mean, I was literally devastated that I wasn't going to be able to. I still can't write or draw the way I used to. It takes a lot of effort, you know. But but hey, it took. I can do it at least, you know. But yeah, man, that's what really knocked me out of the game. It was like most disappointing, discouraging thing was the injuries, man. As far as like just not getting where I wanted to, yeah, that was never a big deal to me because I never really had that mindset that I'm gonna go to the WWF, I'm gonna main event WrestleMania. I didn't think I really was prepared for that, and I think that's probably what held me back all those years. Honestly, it's all in your head, you know.
Yeah, definitely. The collarbone injury, too. If anyone listening has not seen the picture that you posted on social media of the staples, holy shit, go check it out. Because, oh, man, that's one of those pictures they go, hello, kids, welcome to wrestling.
Yeah.
That was a good little zipper there. Huh?
Oh, it was crazy. It was crazy. Now, did when you got that injury, it was Lucha was taping season 4. Obviously your injury has caused Lucha to not come back. you know, speaking of LU, what were some of your favorite things about the way that they did it? Because it was something that was different production wise and talent wise, man. It was almost like, you know, everyone was kind of a kind of close knit family and stuff. What were some of your, you know, reactions to how it was done, and it's a shame that they're having these kind of problems that they're having getting it back up.
Yeah, you know, as far as all the contract stuff and legal stuff, you know, I really can't speak on that end because thankfully I wasn't involved in any of that. My deal was a little bit different. It wasn't a contracted deal. It was basically a by-episode deal. So even though I was paid very well and we were taken very good care of, I was never contracted to them. So when all this stuff went down, I could just kind of turn around and do whatever I wanted, thankfully.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, I wanted a contract, and now I'm glad I didn't get one. I mean, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah. And now you've got a contract.
Right. Yeah. No, but Lucha Underground will always, I'll always have a soft spot for it. I mean, it was 4 amazing years. That definitely career highlight. Nothing but good memories from everyone involved there, other than, you know, the bad injury, obviously. But that whole 4th season was kind of a disaster, to be honest with you. But everything, you know, the way we did it, when we first started doing it, just like everyone else, I pretty much had my own reservations. I'm like, what the hell are we doing? This is the most whack thing I've ever been a part of. And then once I think we started taping maybe the 3rd or 4th episode, we started getting the groove, and I'm like, you know what? This is pretty badass. And we really cranked out something that I'm really proud of. I love that show, and I, you know, take what you want from it, but in all reality, it was a trendsetter. I mean, it kind of lost its buzz, unfortunately. And I think when they, I think it was season 3 when they took the hiatus right in the middle of the season.
Yeah,
they kind of killed them. Yeah, that killed their momentum, and it never really recovered after that, I don't think. And you know, hindsight's perfect. You know, saying they shouldn't have done that, but man, yeah, that just kind of killed the show. But yeah, nothing but good memories there. Fantastic talent, but looking at, like, you know, the way it influenced the wrestling world in general, you can't deny it. I mean, within a few months, you started seeing a lot more intergender type stuff in WWE. You started seeing the more cinematic approach to some of their segments and vignettes and the you know, the haunted house segments and stuff. You know, I mean, if you don't think that came from Lucha Underground, come on, you didn't see the show, obviously. and it's kind of, you know, and it's kind of cool to be a part of something like that. And I think AEW is kind of a lot of the same thing. You know, one of the knocks on WWE over the last several years was that the referees were always buried. They're never mentioned. They're nameless faceless guys, nameless guys. Don't even mention them. Suddenly, you know, after Double or Nothing, the referees were kind of featured a little more prominently by the commentators and in the matches. Now suddenly you see the referees being mentioned on WWE. You see the little video segment on Mike Chioda that's floating around. Suddenly the referees are being talked about in WWE. Yeah. They watch all that stuff, you know. You might think they don't, but they do. They come off with very much that we're the big dog and we don't pay attention, but you know damn well they pay attention.
Definitely. Yeah, without question. And, you know, you go back a while with the Bucks. Has it been unbelievable to see what they've accomplished in the last in this short amount of time in the last couple of years?
Oh, it's mind blowing. It really is. I mean, you know, I traveled with them on our last trip to Florida a week or two ago, whenever it was, and it's crazy because you're literally traveling with a couple of rock stars. I mean, people in the airport wants their picture. People, we went to eat at Chili's. People want to, the waiters want to take their picture. The people in the restaurant want their picture. We went to a place called Wawa, which is like a 7-Eleven, right. You know. Yeah, and we were in there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the freaking people wanted pictures with the Young Bucks. I mean, and wow. It's unreal. And it's like, to them, they're not even fazed by it. You know, you get back in the car and drive away, and they're just like, it didn't even happen. They're just talking about something. I'm like, that was fucking cool. It was just, all these people were marking out for you guys. They're like, oh, yeah, whatever, you know. it's a trip, man. They've really accomplished a lot, and I'm really grateful for everything that they've given me here.
Yeah, furthermore, was it surreal when they offered you a contract, like, out of nowhere?
Oh yeah, it was. It really was. I mean, you know, we'd been talking there. I knew something was coming, but the way they did it, the way they dropped the bomb on me there was as legit as it can be, and it was an incredible moment, man. I'll never forget that shit.
Right, because you know a lot of people know that Joey Ryan's contract is up, and so they thought that the Bucks were there to offer him a contract, and then boom, yeah. There you go, they lay it on you.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking. I mean, and same thing. I think when they sprung it on Brandon Cutler, same sort of scenario.
Oh, then, yeah.
You know, you kind of knew it was coming. They had said, "Yeah, hold your horses. We're gonna have something for you." But then when they did it, it was just such an awesome feel good moment, man. It another moment that brought me to tears. I think he's such a good guy too. He deserves everything, man. He's awesome.
Definitely. And you know, now you look at it, and you're probably based a lot locally on the West Coast, but now you're going to be traveling all over again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, they kind of told me what the first few weeks of TV and everything is going to be like. And, yeah, we're going to be on the move. Come October 1st, it'll be a weekly traveling. It's going to get crazy.
How's the family reacting to the fact that it's going to be more travel days for you?
They're okay. I mean, thankfully, I don't have kids. I've only got my wife, and I've got, you know, dogs and cats, and I've got a lot of nephews and nieces, and my parents are still around, and they're all local. You know, they're all excited for me. You know, obviously, my wife's, you know, a little bit nervous. I'm going to be gone so much, but she knows that it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Yeah,
question. Man, we're living the dream right now. It's and right now, I mean, I've technically been under contract since May 1st, and we really don't get rocking and rolling until October. So it's like this summer months is almost like just an incredibly amazing paid vacation. And I feel a little guilty sitting at home, you know, but it's just the nature of what we're doing right now, you know?
Yeah.
So that gives you a little bit of time being at home. I know you said you're a huge fan of The Who. How, have you seen them in concert? And you know, what gravitates you to their music?
I have seen them. I've probably seen them maybe close to a dozen times, I'll be going again in October 13th, I think, at the Hollywood Bowl. I got tickets for that show. But as far as what gravitates me to them, you know, I don't know. I think they have such an eclectic catalog of music from their early poppy R&B stuff to the more experimental psychedelic stuff to the progressive rock opera type stuff. I don't know. It's just, you know, the original four musicians that comprised the band, I mean, the four of them together just were magic, I think. Yeah. And even though I still buy and collect everything that they put out, even after Moon and Insolence of Death, you know, it's not the same, but I still appreciate it and still like it for what it is. But yeah, something about those years, you know, 65 to 78, the music they put out just grabs me. And I've been a fan since I was probably 12 years old. I don't know.
What's your top three songs?
Well, I'm a big fan. My all-time favorite album is Quadrophenia, so I would probably have to pull a few tracks off of Quadrophenia. I like Punk Meets the Godfather. Yeah. I like Cut My Hair. I like The Real Me. You know, but I also like the Who's Next album. You can't deny that one. Every song is a radio hit, you know, I could go on. I could go on all day about The Who.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, I love everything from, you know, 68, 69 on. But it's like I go through the phases of going back to the early stuff, like a Boris the Spider and Substitute and, you know, Pictures of Lily. I mean, a song about masturbation that comes out in like 1965. How fucking great is that? You know?
I know. That's awesome. And, you know, and that's, even though those songs are kind of flippant and they're a little poppy, I mean, listen to the bass tracks on the shit down, man. They were pretty badass. And that Live at Leeds album from 1970, the greatest live album ever. I mean, that's like heavy metal before there was heavy metal.
Well, it's interesting that you said that because, you know, a lot of the early stuff, because they were mod, I think that was almost the basis for, you know, kind of a punk sound. And then, the States, you know, you got the MC5 and the Stooges, and it just kind of evolved, I think, out of what the mod sound was. And then you said heavy metal, and it's like, yeah, the Who then, instead of staying in that chorus, when they got more psychedelic, after that, where do you go? And then, like you said, yeah, it's like, you start listening to the bass and the guitar work, and it's just fucking amazing what they were able to accomplish.
And what was so unique about them, too, is as far as, like, they were so untraditional in the fact that you had the bass player playing the rhythm section like a lead, and you had the lead guitarist playing it like a rhythm, that was part of the magic. I mean, that's why I don't think, you know, you hear the story of how at one point, Entwistle and Moon wanted to break off and form a band with Jimmy Page, and they were going to be Led Zeppelin, you know, before Led Zeppelin took off. It wouldn't have worked, man. It's like those four dudes. It had to be those four, you know, and same thing with Led Zeppelin. If you would have had any other four, it wouldn't have been the same, you know.
Exactly. Another thing that you're interested in, and I find this very funny because you became an LA Kings fan since around 89, you say. Which I laugh about because I know exactly where this is going. Gretzky comes to L.A.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I could give two shits about sports or anything, really, when I was young, but suddenly hockey was on TV a lot, you know, and I'm like, what, you know, and it's, you kind of check it out for a little bit, and you're like, you know what, this is pretty cool. And then I think I first started really getting into it, like, the year of the 89 playoffs, and I was like, oh, shit, playoff hockey is insane. And the next, you know, luckily those first few years I was a fan, the Kings did fairly good. I mean, they made it into the playoffs, you know, every year. And then 93, they made the run all the way to the Cup. But, you know, then the shit show started for the next 10 years or so. I would alter Wayne Gretzky. I totally did. Had he not come to LA, I would have never watched, you know?
Well, it's funny.
Total bandwagoner.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, it's funny that you say that because I grew up in Chicago, huge Blackhawks fan, but became a Kings fan in 89 because of Gretzky going there. And the two teams paralleled each other for a while there because the Hawks lost in 92 to the Penguins. Yeah. And then the Kings the next season, the Kings lost to the Penguins. And it's like, I hated that fucking Mario Lemieux. Oh, Mario Lemieux could he was so good and was so fucking bad.
Lemieux was pretty sick. I mean, he was a giant on the ice, but he could do it all, man. It's too bad. I mean, that he, you know, had such a short illness plagued injury or career, because, man, he could have definitely rewrote the record books. I think he was badass.
With that being said, who is your all-time favorite hockey player?
I always got to give it to Wayne Gretzky. Yeah. I mean, I really do. I know it's a corny answer, but like I said, he's responsible for me being a fan. You know, and those early years when he was a king, it wasn't just him. That entire team was like a fantastic cartoon characters, you know. I mean, they all, you had Marty McSorley and, you know, yeah. Gary Curry, Paul Coffey, all these dudes. Tony Granato.
Granato,
you know,
yeah.
These dudes, they were all characters, and so they made watching hockey so much fun those first few years. I mean, you know, and the way the Kings played in those Smythe Division days, you know, it was very much run and gun, so
yeah.
They gave up a lot of goals, but they scored a lot of goals, so it was always fun to watch, and they didn't always win, but you know, they made the playoffs every year those first few years, and yeah, it was always exciting. But I have to say, man, it's got to be Wayne Gretzky. I owe everything to him.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, you parallel the love of wrestling with the love of hockey, and a lot of us have the same kind of passion for both, and a lot of that has to do, I think, with the fact that they're both two sports, I'm going to call, you know, wrestling a sport, where guys are so athletic. And when they do the things that they can do to precision, it's amazing. It's great that, you know, you get to, you know, watch hockey games and then be in the middle of wrestling matches. You're living out all of our dreams when we were, you know, kids in the 80s growing up. Yeah,
pretty much it. That's what it feels like, man. Just out here play fighting with my friends, you know.
Well, let me ask you something, because you've been watching for ages now, 80s. We just talked about it. Who did you admire when, you know, you started watching wrestling?
When I really started getting into it, like, I mean, you know, when I was really, really little, like, you know, 3 years old, it was always on in my house. So I have memories of Freddie Blassie, John Tolles, Mill Masters. But I didn't really become a fan until I started watching, like, WWF in, like, 83, 84.
Yeah.
But the guys who I liked, who, I don't know, I didn't necessarily follow. I think I tended to like the heels a little bit more. You know, I like the bad guys. But I like the athletic guys. I like the high flyers. So I was a big Superfly Snuka fan.
Oh, yeah.
I was big on, I loved the Von Erichs. I was a mark for them, even though I hated good guys, you know. let's see, who else did I loved, Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy, when they were first coming in from Calgary, and you know, you would see them on WWF TV occasionally before they were called the British Bulldogs, you know.
Right.
I was just so blown away by those guys, but you didn't get to see them a lot on TV, but man, I always looked for Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy, and these were even before the, you know, tape trading days.
Right.
But I used to write my friends in Canada through all my, like, punk rock fanzine, cartooning connections and stuff, and I would tell them, my friend named Kai, who lived up in Vancouver, I'd be like, oh man, I love Dynamite Kid and Bret Hart and Davey Boy. And he'd be like, how are you seeing these guys? They're local. I'm not here. I'm like, I don't know. They're on WWF TV sometimes, you know. And he started sending me shit from up there. And that's how I started getting really turned on to the Calgary stuff. And then I really, you know, that was like a whole different type of wrestling. I mean, it was almost like you would watch WWF, and then you would watch World Class or Calgary, and it looked like these guys were really competing against each other.
Yeah, very snug.
So much more realistic, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, transitioning, you know, talking about your career a little bit, you know, how did you and where did you get started, you know, with the refereeing? Like, what organization?
When I first started with the School of Hard Knocks, you know, their home promotion was the EWF.
Right.
And so the first year or two, I probably did pretty much just EWF shows. But sometimes we would kind of like when there would be a group that would come through town called the NWF, and they would like run shows at, like, the minor league baseball stadiums, and they would have, like, WWF guys on the card, and then they'd fill up the undercard with Bill and Jesse's guys, and, you know, and I would get to that. So, like, that's where I got to first meet and work with guys like the Bushwhackers and Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov, Greg Valentine, Honky Tonk Man, Hacksaw Duggan. So, I mean, as a guy just a couple years into the business, getting the opportunity to work shows with these guys was a dream come true. I mean, I never thought I'd get bigger than that, you know. And then probably, I guess, 99 or 2000, Bill and Jesse split.
Right.
Bill has formed the IWC, International Wrestling Council, and I kind of went with him and started doing those shows. And then around that same time is when I started doing UPW. And after that, I mean, all bets were off, man. I mean, once you started hitting UPW, it was like everybody suddenly knew who you were, and I was booked everywhere after that.
Yep, and I definitely remember you, although you wouldn't know me from Adam. the fact of the matter was is that, you know, those shows that that we put on with UPW there, you talk about what you're feeling now in some of the like local promotions out here in FSW. I know bar wrestling has that kind of feel to it. It's just amazing that, you know, 20 years later now, we're finally seeing that resurgence of, you know, it's cycled back finally.
It's kind of funny you mentioned FSW because Alcatraz and I had this conversation like a few years back when Joe first started bringing me in to do FSW shows. He was like, you know, dog, this is just like UPW. I'm like, you know what? It totally is. It feels just like it. It's got the same vibe. I mean, it that was part of what made it so fun too, I think. You know, UPW, it's like, that was a lot of our first exposure doing like big tight production shows.
Yep.
And looking back, it's like, man, they were so goddamn stressful. And they didn't need to be, you know. I mean, I think Bassman made us all basket cases and just over stressed everyone out. And looking back at it now, it's like, you know, we were driving ourselves nuts for no reason. We could have just laid back and probably put on a much better, smoother show. But hey, it's part of the learning process, you know.
Well, yeah, and at that time, marijuana wasn't legal, so
didn't stop most of us.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah, no. is there a particular person that stands out to you on the California scene over the years that kind of defines what it has meant to be a wrestler in California? Is there someone that you can kind of go, you know what, every time I've been in the ring with him, this is a guy who just nails it?
Right now, I would say the shooting star from our area, Scorpio Sky, probably.
Yeah.
You know, he's just a phenomenal athlete from top to bottom. And I think you'll probably see him. I don't know this, but I think you'll probably see him get a little bit more of a singles push out of the SCU group.
Yeah.
Because in all reality, he's a star of the group. I think sky's the limit for him, no pun intended, but he's a true pro, he's a consummate, and I mean, he's getting booked everywhere. He's you know, traveling all around, his name's getting out there. You know, I know he had a bump in the road with WWE when he like, they dug up an old tweet of his or something where he said something homophobic or something, and it kind of, I guess, ruined his chances of ever getting in there, but thankfully, that's not the only ball game in town anymore.
Right.
But I cannot say enough about him. I think he has all the capabilities of being a top star in the business. And ever since I've known him, he's been that way. Just humble, nicest guy, always smiling. You know, always positive. And I think he deserves a good run with, you know, whatever level of championship he should be at.
And it was also very smart of Kaz and Daniels to, you know, start that faction with him because of the fact that when you start hitting that certain age, it's like, hey, now we got the young kid superstar to take some of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of funny, even like you look at Daniels. I mean, the guy, he's technically, I think I'm a year older than him still. But I mean, he, you know, obviously class A performer, top notch. Because I've known him and seen him and worked so closely with him over the past 20 years, I can see the little things where he's slowing down. You know, I can see the weird little things where the age is kicking in. I'm sure I'm seeing it on myself and showing it myself too. But you're absolutely right. Now they got the guy who can come in and do all the spectacular stuff. And they're hitting a home run with that whole stable. I think it's an awesome gimmick.
And it's brilliant because Sky can do the, you know, the spectacular stuff. Frankie bleeds wonderfully. And, you know, and Daniels can still tell a story by, you know, yeah. you just lock up with him, and Chris can tell a story through his eyes, and it's just like, fuck, man. Oh, yeah. Effortless.
You know, I know it's a old stupid cliche, but he could literally have a badass match with a broom in the ring.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, apparently Omega could have a badass match with a blow-up doll in the ring, and people are pissed off, so.
yeah, why not?
Hey, let me ask you, before we move on, is there a favorite match that you've refereed this, you know, throughout your career? I know that's kind of hard.
It is a very hard question, and I do get asked that quite a bit. It's hard to really just pick, there was this great match. But I do like to kind of pull this one out for a multitude of reasons. Well, a couple of them. I always go back to, like, the Vampiro Pentagon match from Ultima Lucha 1. I mean, that was awesome. One of my best friends was in the audience, and they basically went brawling right in his lap, and he did not know what the hell to make of that. I mean, it was so amazing, and of course he made it on camera, so it was a thrill of his lifetime. But the main event for All In last year, the six man, you know, just for so many reasons, I'll never forget that. Number one, just because of the star power in it being the main event of that show, which was historic in its own right. But the fact that we literally went out there and they had an 18-minute match set up, and as we're in the ring, they tell me over my earpiece that our match has been cut to 11 minutes. Yeah, and they're like, you have to end the match or we're going to lose the pay-per-view feed. You will go off the air and while the match is still going. You guys have to end it. So I'm like, fuck. So, I mean, literally, this is probably the most stressful thing I'd ever been a part of because, I mean, we've got three Mexican guys, a Japanese guy, you know, and a couple American guys.
Yeah.
And we pulled it off. I mean, I was yelling at them, you know, cut this, go to this, get rid of that, do that. And it was just kind of a blur, you know, the whole thing. Literally, we hit the finish, 1, 2, 3. I raised Matt and Nick's hand, and the pay-per-view feed cut. Yeah. Boom. I mean, had we not made that, we would have been the laughing stock of the whole wrestling world. But right. We pulled it off. Yeah. And when we got to the back, BJ Whitmer was like, you know, dude, that was freaking awesome. You nailed it. You barked orders to them. You took control of that match. I could see you were the right guy in the ring at the right time, and we're so glad that we had you out there. And it really made me feel good that it felt like I did something right, that, you know, we pulled that match together. I mean, just like I said, had we not done that and finished that match and the pay-per-view feed ended while we're still wrestling, yeah, that would have been horrible. But luckily we pulled it off. Just barely, but we pulled it off.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you think about things like that, the small intricacies of a match. Yeah. People don't understand how important the referee is to the whole show.
Well, and I mean, if you go back and you watch that match now that you know, you'll see how frantic that is. I mean, they don't stop, they don't sell, they don't go into any rest. It's like, it's literally a sprint from beginning to end. And, it was nerve-wracking, it really was, but it was incredibly rewarding as well, because I really felt good afterwards. I felt like, you know, wow, we actually had some adversity there and pulled it off, and with the language barrier and all that, it was, we felt real good about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and, you know, same thing, like, the fight for the Fallen last week, you know. Yeah. These guys, they did not have time to prepare a match, you know. They literally went out there with little to no preparation or communication with these guys. They still put on a 5-star match, basically, but you can tell it was a little scrambled and disjointed because the Lucha Brothers literally didn't show up till like maybe a half hour before the show, you know. Whoa. And it was like they basically got dressed, ran out there, and had that match. And it was like, shit, if they could have maybe had a little bit more time, better preparation, we could have really knocked it dead. But just the fact that they were able to do what they did with the limited resources they had just impresses the hell out of me. It just blows me away. They're all such pros.
Yeah, you know, we covered it. We talked about it last week on our show, how even though you have these executives who are part of the show with the Young Bucks and Kenny, they are, even though they're not in the main event, every single time out now, All In, Double or Nothing, and last week's show, you know, they steal the show.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
It's just, it's incredible, you know, and it's good for them for not putting themselves in that main slot right away and finding different storylines to be a part of. It just really shows how professional they are, because you could easily, as an executive, put yourself over.
Well, yeah, and, you know, part of the thing, too, like with the Young Bucks, they even at Double or Nothing, they didn't want to go over in that match. They wanted the Lucha Brothers to go over, but, you know, the office was kind of adamant, like, hey, this is our first big event. We're talking, you know, we've been putting you guys over as the greatest tag team in the world. We ain't going to have you go out there and lose on our first pay-per-view.
I could totally see that.
You can't really argue with that, you know, but... I don't expect to see the Young Bucks be the first tag champs, and I don't expect them to have a long run with the belts or anything. I mean, literally, they're going to be putting everyone else over.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And we just talked about Chicago, and I know one of the things that you're really passionate about is the Mafia. Yeah. And I am too. When I heard about how passionate you are about it, I am. Through and through, I've been following, you know, organized crime for many years, and we actually have the Mob Museum here. Have you been there?
No. In fact, I wanted to go, but when we were in Chicago, I literally ran out of time, and the day of the show, I drove into the city, and traffic was so bad, we literally had to turn right around and go back to the arena. So hopefully this time I'll have a chance to do it.
Oh, actually, it's Mob Museum's in Vegas.
Oh, the Vegas one.
Yeah. Yeah, but they have one in Chicago,
I've never
too.
I've been to that one, yeah. I've never been to that one. I've heard all about it, but, yeah, never been there.
Well, then, when you're headed this way, just let us know. We'll gladly go down there with you, brother, because...
That would be cool.
Yeah, it's a fun experience. It's a good time. I know I've gone a few times. Lucky's gone a few times. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and then they just put in a speakeasy. In the basement.
Yes, very nice.
So, very cool.
Some nice spirits down there.
I'm actually reading a book right now called Handsome Johnny, which is about Johnny Roselli, who was a big Vegas guy, you know, and a Hollywood guy back in the 40s and 50s. Really good book, and I definitely put it over. If you're into reading crime books, check this one out called Handsome Johnny. The author's name is Lee Server, I think, and I'm almost done with it. Can't put it down. Really good.
That's excellent.
I am going to task you with a huge task. What's your favorite Mafia movie?
You know, obviously, the Godfather always has that special feel, you know, but I mean, it's such a romanticized bullshit version of the Mafia that it's not even accurate, but I mean, it's still a great movie. But I mean, I always thought Goodfellas nailed it the best.
Oh, yeah.
As far as, you know, what it's really like. Now I'm a big fan of the old gangster movies from like the 30s and 40s, you know, Little Caesar, Public Enemy, stuff like that. My favorite one is Angels with Dirty Faces with James Cagney.
Yeah,
love that movie. But as far as like just the reality or the realism, Goodfellas nails it. I thought Casino nailed it too. They did really good in that one.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm gonna ask you this as well too. They just came out with a John Gotti movie last year, but the original
John
Gotti movie.
One,
yeah. Have you seen both of those?
No, and I want to really bad. Because I thought the John Travolta one was pretty good, so I got to check it out.
Well, so I saw the original one, which was with Armand Hassan, which was very well done. And then I got to the one with John Travolta, and it just was lost on me. I mean,
I remember that one with Armand Asante. I think I've got, I remember that one too.
Yeah, but I really wanted it to
too
work.
Because I remember like the previews for it, they looked like they had the look down and everything looked pretty good. That's too bad that it sucks, but oh well.
Well, at the same time, I thought the funniest thing is, here you have John Travolta playing Gotti, after coming off of playing Robert Shapiro in the OJ series. And it just, you know, it just kind of blows the mind. Like, oh my God, it's like John's such a good actor, but yet when he's playing someone for real life, it's just kind of a little awkward. And, you know.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, because I got to admit, man, like when you watched him as a youngster and like Welcome back, Hodder.
Yeah.
You thought he was that freaking stupid, man. You literally thought that was him. I mean, you nailed that character good.
Well, and the sad thing is if you were a kid like me, Barbarino was your hero, so I don't know what that says about me. It's like, yeah, I chose the Fonz and Barbarino, probably two of the most cool guys but stupid guys in television history.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, we're from the same age group, man.
And speaking of that age group, Old School Punk, I know you did some drawings and stuff. What was your tie-in and experience, and were there any of the LA bands that influenced you at that time?
Yeah, I mean, when I was young, my brother, who was 3 years older than me, was in a band. So he got to his band was called Ceasefire. They got to open up for a lot of big bands that came through Riverside here. They got to open up for Black Flag, Circle Jerks, Dead Kennedys. So I got to see all those bands. I got to sit on stage, take pictures of those bands and stuff, and yeah, it was a dream come true back then, and you know, used to go to the big shows in L.A. at the Olympic Auditorium, and I remember the first time I walked into the Olympic for a punk show, I had never seen that many punk rockers in one place, and it was just amazing. It was like a big, giant prison, and you were down in the general population. It was just insane the way that place was set up. But, yeah, and so my brother was in a band, and then a couple of my schoolmates were in bands as well. I never got into playing, which is a regret. You know, you always regret things you didn't do in life, and I never really learned an instrument. I wish I did. But yeah, going to see their bands play all the time was my connection. And of course, I got to take pictures, and I was a cartoonist. So back then, you used to draw cartoons. You'd send them to the fanzines on the other side of the country, and they would send to the fanzines back, and you would trade stuff, flyers and records. It was pretty fun, you know, back in the days before the internet and all that.
Right.
You basically did it all through the mail, and it was exciting. Every day you'd get a new package in the mail and see what new punk rock you were getting, and it was a pretty magical time too. I mean, you look back on those early days of the punk scene, and it was pretty cool. As far as like the LA and Orange County bands, though, they were a big influence. Always a big Black Flag fan.
Yeah.
Loved the TSOL and the Adolescents. they seemed like, even though they were the next county over, they were still part of our scene, it seemed like, you know.
If you had your choice, what group, if you had one, you know, one concert left, the group's intact, let's say, you know, so dead or alive, what would be the one punk group that you would choose as your final concert?
Let's see, like, you know, go back in time sort of thing, or
sure,
like bring them all back right now?
Yeah, go back in time. I guess,
I never got to see Minor Threat play live.
Oh.
That would have been cool to have seen. But pretty much everyone else I got the opportunity to see at some point. So, never got to see Minor Threat. Never got to see the original lineup of The Clash, which kind of sucked.
Yeah.
That would have kind of been cool to have seen them in like a 1976 or something. That would have been badass. But yeah, I guess that everyone else, I think I pretty much got to see, you know, growing up. So
that's pretty awesome. Did you, by any chance, going back to 2002, did you go out to the concert that was, it's now the San Manuel, but back then it was the Blockbuster Pavilion, where they had K-Rock did the punk day, and it was like Bad Religion, Social D, X was there, and then it was headlined by Offspring, and then it was the Sex Pistols.
I did not go to that. I do remember that. It was the big festival out there in DeBoer or whatever it was. And then I think there was also another big one they did at the Orange Show, Orange Pavilion out there in San Bernardino, but I don't think Sex Pistols played at that one. But.
No, yeah, I think the only time the Sex Pistols played was that one in DeBoer, which was a fabulous day until Blink 182 played.
Yeah, that would ruin it.
Oh, dude, it was brutal. It was brutal. You talk about a bunch of, like, if you listen to the music on CD, it's polished. If you listen to them live, they can't fucking play a lick. Like, even punk rock, you know, like, you don't have to know much to play punk rock. It's like,
that's too bad, because I think that's what a lot of these newer bands, they get into that overproduction scheme. And you know, something about punk bands out of the 90s, just, you know, they lost their way or something. I don't know, man. It's like, I don't have Sirius radio or satellite radio, but I had a rental car recently, and I had it, and I, you know, I was thinking, oh man, there's gonna be a bunch of punk stations. There was like one punk station on there, and it was like all these crappy 90s bands. It was like Blink 182, Teenage Bottle Rocket, all this weird shit. I'm like, just, you know, they lost me. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I just grew out of it or something, but like the stuff that came out like in the mid to late 90s on, just for the most part, kind of sucks, I think. I don't know, it's just, they lost me, I guess.
Well, I think, you know, what happened too is that I think the generations lost the actual angst behind everything, because the last, you know, the last real movement you saw with the angst was in the grunge scene. You know, I think punk evolved into grunge, and then you know, corporations basically killed teenage angst, because it's just like, all of a sudden it's like, we only listen to, you know, this polished new stuff, and it, all the punk songs now that, you know, are coming from these bands are all you know, about relationships and
exactly. I was just gonna say that, you know, back then, you know, before, the punk bands had a message, and it was like, you know, fuck the police, fuck the government, whatever. And now it's like, I want to fuck this girl, and it's, it's not what punk rock was when I was growing up. But, you know, that's just me being old. It's what I credit it to, just me being old and not keeping up, I guess. It happens to every generation, I suppose, you know, damn kids, you know.
With that too, speaking of, I know that you're a comic book guy.
Oh yeah.
Especially the old comic books, and you do the superhero movies. Are you more apt in DC or Marvel?
Well, when I was a kid, I think I was a little more into DC, and so there's a little bit of a nostalgic flavor there for the old DC stuff. Yeah. But, you know, when I was in my early teens, it quickly came to the realization that the Marvel comics were much better.
Yeah.
As far as better stories, better characters, better, you know, just they captivated you. Where, just a difference between a Spider-Man story and a Superman story of the early 70s are worlds apart, you know. And, so, all in all, Marvel's definitely the way to go, but yeah, I always have that nostalgic feel for DC, especially the Golden Age and Silver Age stuff. I mean, that's what I loved as a kid and always will hold close to my heart.
Let me ask you this. So, I'm torn about this whole thing with Robert Pattinson becoming Batman, and I thought Ben Affleck was doing a somewhat good job of being Batman, but then they scrapped it. You know, I know he went through this whole thing where he, you know, had some alcohol problems and stuff like that, but then he came back and stepped down. How do you feel? Do you feel like, I mean, I know they'll never put this thing together the way that Marvel did, but do you think that was the right call for him to step away?
You know, I don't know. It is kind of, that's a hard question. I mean, it's definitely established that DC is chasing Marvel's tail at this point. I mean, they'll, like you said, they'll probably never get to that same level of good quality movies and stories. I mean, I would love it if they would, but I tend to think that maybe Affleck stepping away does kind of take away from that a little bit, and maybe hurt the franchise a little.
Yes.
But I don't think that people are giving Robert Pattinson a fair shake either. I mean, he's an actor. He's a versatile guy. I think he'll pull it off, and he'll pull it off great. He'll be fine, you know. I'm more concerned about this new Joker movie. I
was just getting ready to go there. You know, you look at this.
Someone made a good point that, like, you know, back in the day, they made the Joker by dropping him in a vat of acid and destroying his mind, and now it's like society made him by bullying him.
Right.
Like, you know, we got a sensitive Joker now.
Well, not only that, but I mean, I just think that when you look at where they were going, and then they had Jared Leto as the Joker, like this kind of new age Joker, which I actually thought he was doing a good job, even though I would have preferred to see them do a kind of like an origin story with him and Harley Quinn versus having them, you know, in there mixed up with the Suicide Squad. But I actually was bought into his, you know, his portrayal of Joker.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, they kind of threw their chips on the table and like, hey, man, this is the way we're going. And people were kind of buying in. I think you're right. That's the route they were going to go. And then it's like, I think this is another thing that's kind of hurting the DC franchise. Too much flip-flopping around and not enough continuity. And, you know, I still haven't seen Shazam either. Everyone really putting over that movie that is really, really good. I still don't really know. Does it tie into the other DC movies? Is it related at all? I don't know.
No.
Yeah, it's totally...
It's totally a standalone by itself, but it fucking worked. It was good.
Yeah, I gotta see that.
Yeah.
So, as we get close to the end here and we wrap up, one of the other things that I find... you know, really interesting is that you actually have been into art and drawing, and like you said, you broke that pinky, which is, you know, kind of hindered it a little bit, but what's the story behind you actually being a published author?
Well, basically, I had created a It was a calendar. It kind of ties back into the organized crime research that I did. And it was basically a wall calendar that you would flip up and hang on your wall. And each day would have a listing of notable events that happened in mob history. You know, like you look at a certain day and it'd be like, so-and-so got murdered in New York. So-and-so got sentenced to life in prison, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And then each month had a collage or an artwork collage that I did myself. And it was all done in, like, I made it 98 for the calendar year of 1999. And so it was all done on, like, my little Photoshop program or my little paint program on the computer. So I've kind of been trying. I want to do it again, basically, but because now I have a whole new way of doing art, and I think I can make it look a lot better now. That was just kind of like something to do and get out there. But it was actually, I did pretty good with it. It was actually sold online in the early days of the internet, and it was on. It was featured on a local newspaper, so that got a lot of mileage out of it. And I was selling it in a lot of the local record stores, comic shops, some local bookstores, stuff like that. So it was kind of cool. It got a lot of play, and. But yeah, it's a lot of work kind of doing all the art for it, but I've started it and restarted it probably 3 times, you know, like, all right, I'm going to do it again. And then I'll start, I'm like, all right, yeah, it's not coming out the way I want. I'm going to start over again. And, you know, but one day I'm going to have it done again, and I'll, hopefully within the next year or two I'll re-release it with a brand new calendar version.
Wow, well, make sure you earmark me for one of those.
I certainly will keep you guys in the loop, and but yeah, I've been drawing, cartooning, and stuff since I was a little kid. It was something my dad did, and I just kind of did it along with him, and been drawing as long as I can remember. But yeah, when I had the injury with my hand, it was a little rough on me because I not only couldn't draw, I couldn't even write. You know, couldn't even write my name or anything, and it took a lot of retraining to do that. And stupid thing, I never didn't even tell you, but like when I did shatter that pinky, it was in the ring and it happened dancing with Rich Swann.
No way.
Yeah, he would come out to, you know, All Night Long, and he reaches out to me, I'd reach out to him, and he would grab me and spin me and all this stuff, and we reached out and clicked our fingers together, and bam, there it went.
No way.
Wow. Yeah, and it was like the first match of the night, too. I remember I had to finish the whole rest of the night. Yeah, and I didn't know it was broken, so I thought, you know, it'll be okay, and of course, like an idiot, I didn't go to the doctor for like a week, and by then it had already started healing, and So when they did the surgery on it, it's pretty fucked. But
was this on your counting hand?
Yes.
Oh, even worse.
Yeah. God. Yeah, it was kind of weird because, like, right after it happened, I remember I tried to count with it, and I couldn't do it. And I remember the fans, like, could tell something was wrong. They were like, oh, you know. So I, like, tried doing it with my left hand, and, like, I could something I need to work on. I really can't count very well with my left hand. So I'm not ready to do it with both hands. I cannot. I need to learn. And so, like, I remember I went into the back after the match, and I just, like, took a shitload of cotton and tape and just taped the hell out of my hand. It looked like I had basically had a catcher's mitt on. And went out there and counted the rest of the show with that and was able to do it. But yeah, it had to basically have steel pins put in that finger. And it's never, I make a fist with that hand and the pinky doesn't even come close to being shut. It's just always going to be like that, I guess.
That sounds like an oh shit moment.
Yeah. You know, it was actually, in a way, it's probably even worse than the collarbone injury, I bet.
Oh.
I mean, I've had, let's see, a broken leg, two broken arms, the broken finger, and the broken collarbone, and probably about three or four concussions, and the dislocated kneecap, and yeah, wrestling's been fun.
What's the gnarliest injury you've ever seen being in there, outside of the ones you've had?
There was a guy who, named, oddly enough, named Lucky, who was wrestling in Orange County at the Anaheim Marketplace, and he was on the outside of the ring, and I think somebody dove on him, and he was the guy catching, and his leg snapped.
Oh.
And you could see the freaking bone sticking out of his leg.
Oh.
That was probably the worst thing that I've seen firsthand. I mean, I've seen a lot of guys get knocked out, concussions, and eyes rolling back, and unresponsive, scary stuff like that. But that was like the grossest, oh my God, thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, they had to call an ambulance for him, and they took him away. And I don't know if he ever even wrestled again. I think he did come back and wrestle like a year later.
Oh, poor guy. Like, jeez.
Well, Rick, look, man, we appreciate your time, man. Let me ask, is there any event you want to promote, or maybe your social media that you want to promote out there?
On Instagram, I think I'm R Knox Referee. On Twitter, I'm Mad Ref. And Facebook, my normal Facebook page, I think I'm always maxed out with like 500 friends, but there is a fan page called Referee Rick Knox that you can probably find and follow me on. I don't post on there as much as I should, but I will. As far as shows I got coming up here, we got All Out in Chicago on the 31st, so that's kind of what I'm looking at.
Well, we're going to look forward to seeing you, man, when the shows get going in the fall. And
cool.
We'll tell everybody, we know this guy. He talked with the Vegas Bad Boys.
Awesome. Please do. Yeah, TNT, Wednesday night, starting October 2nd, I believe it is.
There it is.
No doubt. Everyone, Rick Knox.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
What's up, everybody? This is your boy Simon Street with the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. Want to let everybody know that on Thursday, September 5th through Friday, September 6th at Sam's Town Hotel Gambling Casino, Impact Live Wrestling is going to be here in Vegas. Again, that's going to be on September 5th and September 6th at Sam's Town Live. We're going to be there. Hope to see you there too.
What's up, y'all? This is Sin City Steve, just urging you to join us, the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting, as we are going to be at ROH, Death Before Dishonor, on September the 27th, live from Sam's Town here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bell time is 6 p.m., and the very next night, September the 28th, there will be a live international TV taping. Again, September 27th and 28th, live at Sam's Town. Come check out Ring of Honor.
Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.